We want to continue on with where we've been, and we've been in the Sermon on the Mount, and we're doing the red letter study that most of you know about. We're going through the words of Jesus, but from an Aramaic first century point of view, which from my point of view changes everything about meaning and about what Jesus was really trying to get across to us. And today, we're in a transition. Last few weeks, we've been going through the Beatitudes and through the salt and light portions. And as we've said, for the last few weeks, what Jesus is doing here is giving us a picture of the finished product. And so the Beatitudes are showing us exactly what does this person look like who lives in kingdom. And when he gets to the salt and light portion, what is the effect that this person has on the community and the people around him or her? The people that are in his or her life. And that idea of salt, that idea of preserving life and fertilizing and bringing zest and flavor and light, you know, bringing this illumination, this understanding and this connection is all of the attributes of the effect of a person who's living in kingdom. Now we're going to go into a transition, and this transition is important. As Jesus moves into the rest of chapter 5, he's going to be talking about law. He's going to be talking about redefining law. What does it mean to be living under the law? And this is a critical piece for all of us. For my money, if we don't understand how to properly look at the law, we will miss the most important thing that Jesus is trying to get across to us, which is the nature of the Father's love. And so this idea of law is so important. I was thinking about it. My 8-year-old son, Marion, wanted to give him vitamins. And so she's trying to give him vitamins, you know, and he's just not going to take those things. You know, the pills, they taste weird if you taste them, and, you know, he doesn't know how to drink and swallow and all that. So she got these gummy vitamins, little Flintstone gummy vitamins. You ever seen those things? How many of you even remember the Flintstones? And we got a few people in here. Okay, good. I'm glad. You wouldn't believe how many people just, these cultural things that are so, you know. I must be getting old. So gummy vitamins. Yeah, I am. I know. Gummy vitamins. And he is just, okay, now this I can handle. He's just eating them down. So I'm up working in my office, and he comes up to me and said, "Dad, can I get some more vitamins?" He calls them vitamins, or he used to. Vitamins. He had crossed a line, see. It had ceased being medicine. It had ceased being something good for him, and it just became candy. It just became something that he enjoyed and something that he loved. You know, at what point are we still obeying anything if it's just what we love to do? See, this is starting to get into the neighborhood of what Jesus is trying to teach us about the law. We have been taught by church, we have been taught by society, we have been taught by the courts, we've been taught by our parents, we've been taught by everything that we know that the law is an absolute instrument. The law is something that must be obeyed on pain of punishment. And we attribute that to the law of God because it looks that way for all intents and purposes, especially when we read these passages from an English point of view, from a modern Western point of view. But what Jesus is trying to get across here is that it's anything but. There's a different quality to the law. And even in his day, the Pharisees, the religious authorities, the rabbis of his day had taken the law so far afield from what it originally was intended to be that not only was it utterly unrecognizable and would have been to the prophets of old, but it was also burdening the people to such an extent that they could never enter kingdom as Jesus understood and was trying to teach that phrase. To enter kingdom. To be able to be completely transparent and present and aware of the Spirit of God and the quality of life that ensues from that very attitude, that very awareness, is impossible if all you're doing is obeying an absolute law. If all you're doing is following rules. If all you're doing is trying to conform to something from the outside, you can't get a handle on what's going on and what Jesus is trying to say. So, starting with the Beatitudes, which are not commandments. Remember we said, the Beatitudes are not commandments. They're not rules. Blessed are you when. Blessed are you when you are merciful. Blessed are you when you mourn. Blessed are you when you're poor in spirit. Moving into salt and light, no commands. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. When you have those attributes that bless you that he talked about before. And now he's going to make this transition, and he's going to start redefining the law for us, showing us what the law really was intended to be at the beginning and how it can be useful for us to move into kingdom. All right? And so this idea that the law is intimately tied to kingdom, but it's not legal. What? The law is intimately tied to kingdom, but it's not legal. It's not a legal law that we're after. Let's take a look at what he says here at Matthew 5, 17 to 19. Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you that until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches other to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. All right, now, everything that I just said seems to be contradicted in what I just read, right? I mean, doesn't this look legal? Doesn't this look intractable? Doesn't this look like it's not going to change? It's going to be there forever. And if we just even make the slightest infraction, we're done. We're least in the kingdom of heaven. So what is going on here? Let's take a look at what Paul says in Romans 10:4. We're going to start to put this together. Paul says, "For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes." So now what is it? Is the law ending or is it being fulfilled? What's going on? And then when you look at Romans 13:8, "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law." What is Paul driving at here? First of all, the word he uses there for the end of the law is telos in Greek. And that means that which completes something, that which perfects something. It's not just the cessation of that thing, the stopping of that thing. It's that which completes it. It's that which fulfills. Jesus and Paul are saying the same thing, tuned to different audiences. Jesus is speaking to Jews and Paul is speaking to Greeks, but he's saying exactly the same thing. And when he moves into 13:8 and he says, "He who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law," we start to understand that for Paul, as for Jesus, the loving of the neighbor, the connection point between people, is the fulfillment of the law, is the completion of the law, that which makes it perfect. And then Paul goes on to Galatians. And Galatians is a really angry book. How many of you are familiar with Galatians? You know? Yeah, beginning of chapter 3, he starts off, "Oh, you foolish Galatians." He's just pounding them. And I love the letters because the letters are, as I've said many times, like a Jeopardy game. You know, you get the answers, but not the questions. So obviously what was going on in Galatia at this time was what was going on all throughout the Eastern Mediterranean in the first few decades after the crucifixion. There was a fight going on between those who believed that anyone who followed Jesus needed to also follow the Judaic code, the dietary code and the purity codes. They need to be Jews first in order to follow Jesus. Paul is preaching to Greeks. They don't know anything about the law. They don't know anything about the dietary codes. And I'll tell you what, for an adult male to undergo circumcision is a really big deal. Nobody wanted to do that. And this is exactly the point at which Galatians falls. These Judaizers, as they were known, these people who were stirring up the following, the congregation, the ecclesia in Galatia, were saying that every male must be circumcised if they are going to be a follower of Jesus. And Paul is going nuts over this. "You foolish Galatians, what bewitched you? How did you get so far off track?" And then in two verses before the one we're going to read here, I love what he says. He says, "You know, for all of those that said we must have circumcision, I hope the knife slips." Come on, think about that for a second. Now, your translation will probably say, "May they mutilate themselves," but it's the same idea. You know, he is being very, very strong here. He's trying to get something across. It's not about being Jews that saves us. It's not even about being lawful that saves us. There's something else. And in Galatians 5:14, he says, for the whole law is fulfilled in one word, in one statement, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Paul couldn't be clearer. And he's backing up Jesus completely here. Being Jewish is not enough. Being lawful is not enough. Not to get you into kingdom, which is this awareness of God's presence, this ability to just let go and abandon yourself to the moment and who each other is in the moment. Just conforming, just following rules is not going to get us there. Yet, at the same time, the law is not irrelevant. Jesus didn't come to abolish it. It's vitally important to us, but it's not legally important to us. And this is what Jesus is also trying to get across to us over and over and over again. Jesus is not abolishing, not ending the law. He's fulfilling and he's completing its intent. Let's go back to what he says up in verse 17. Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, that until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or smallest stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Now this small letter or stroke, some of your translations might say jot and tittle. Some of them may say yud. The yud is what is translated into jot in Greek, and it stands for a letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the smallest letter. It corresponds with our letter I. And the stroke, the smallest stroke, would be little, like diacritical marks, just little strokes that would appear above or below letters to change them from one form to another. It's kind of like the little stroke that changes a C into a G in our alphabet, or an O into a Q, that little stroke there. And so that became an idiomatic phrase for everything, including just the smallest pieces. Jesus says none of that will pass away until the law is accomplished. And by law there, namosa in Aramaic, he's talking about something that relieves weakness, something that strengthens, something that guides and instructs and helps us to move in certain directions. And this is important to understand because our idea of law as a legal document, as a rule that is absolute, is not the understanding here. It's kind of like, the pirate code in Pirates of the Caribbean. Keep to the code, keep to the code. And when they don't, well, it's more of a guideline, not really a code, The Torah, the law of Moses, really properly translated is the instruction or the guidance of Moses. It's like a hand at the small of your back that is guiding you through, gently directing and moving us where we need to go. That was the original understanding of what law was. But it got moved and perverted and pushed in different directions. But even more understanding is this, more interesting to me, is this idea of passing away. Abar in Aramaic, to pass away. When we think of something passing away, we think of it ending. When we think of heaven and earth passing away, we're thinking about the end times generally. At the time when all heaven and earth are going to end and something else is going to take place, end of time as we know it. But abar, to pass away in Aramaic, literally means to cross a boundary, to go beyond a limit. And the idea here is that Jews understood that human beings lived between heaven and earth. Heaven, Shemaiah, was understood as a place of complete unity, complete connection. It was a place where God lived. And everything there was brought into oneness, into unity, because that's who God is. God is oneness, multiple things functioning as one. Earth was a place of individual form, of separation. It's each of us living in our bodies and feeling separated from each other. Particular form, individuality, disconnection. And so the job of a human being living between heaven and earth was to bring heaven to earth, the unity and connection of Shemaiah into Ara, into earth, and to bring earth to heaven, to merge the two. When Jesus prays in the Lord's Prayer, your will be done as in heaven, so on earth, it's the same sentiment, it's the same idea. To merge the two. So literally, until heaven and earth pass away, to cross the boundary is to watch heaven and earth cross their boundaries and merge into oneness between the two. And so the idea here is that law is necessary. Law as a guide, law as an instructor, is necessary as long as we live between heaven and earth. But once we bring earth and heaven together, once the two cross their boundaries and become one, then law is no longer necessary. It's only needed while we live in these individual bodies. And this can happen internally as well. For each of us who move into kingdom, what is a kingdom moment except the merging of heaven and earth? In that moment, there is no law. At that moment, the vitamins are candy. We're not taking them because we have to. We're not taking them because we need to. We're taking them because we love to. And when we move into that moment, the law becomes unnecessary. This is what Jesus is saying here. The law is only necessary until heaven and earth become one. And then in verse 18, whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven, but whoever keeps and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. And what he's alluding to here was the Pharisees' practice of dividing the law into lesser and greater commandments. They had 613 written laws that they recognized from the scriptures, what we call the Old Testament. 613. But they divided some into lesser and some into greater. It's kind of like if you grew up Catholic, there were venial sins and mortal sins. You know, the venial sins will give you some problems, but they're not going to take you to hell, and the mortals will. And so the Pharisees were kind of saying, well, you know, if you break one of these lesser commandments, you know, it's a trivial matter. It's not a big deal. But these over here, what Jesus is saying, as soon as you descend into that kind of thinking, as soon as you take the law and move it apart from the intent of the law, then you are least in the kingdom of heaven because you've misunderstood the whole purpose. Now you're following rules. Now you're nitpicking. Now as, what was his name? The famous actor said, looking for loopholes. You know, on his deathbed, he was an atheist, and on his deathbed, someone caught him reading the Bible. What are you doing there, Bill? W.C. Fields, what are you doing there, Bill? Looking for loopholes. As soon as we enter into that mindset, we've completely lost the whole intent of what the law is about. That's why Jesus is saying you will be least. Because everybody knew what he was talking about. Everybody understood what the Pharisees said about least and greater commandments. But to even think that way, you have moved into a different mindset that shelves you off. What is the purpose of the law? The purpose of the law, first and foremost, was to preserve life, to preserve the integrity of the Hebrew nation. I mean, it can be said that without the law, without Torah being followed as assiduously as it's been followed for over 4,000 years, there would not be a recognizable Israel. There would not be a recognizable Jewish people. It's the law, with all of its precepts, its dietary codes, and its purity codes, is what has kept the nation of Israel recognizable. How many Hittites do you know running around? How many Sumerians? You know? But the Jews, contemporary with those ancient peoples, still exist because the law has preserved their life. That was its intent. And beyond that was to create the ongoing awareness of God's presence and spirit. He went before them like a pillar of fire in the day and a pillar of cloud at night. His Shekinah glory, the Shekinah, that palpable, visible presence that hung over the tent of meeting was that peace. Following the law the way the Jews did, you couldn't take more than 10 steps without being reminded of your God and your relationship to him. It was coded into your daily prayers that you said it multiple times today. It was coded into the way that you wore your clothing, the way that the knots were tied as they hung from your prayer shawl. You had to prepare your food a certain way. You ate at certain times, and all of the holy days and feast days and things. All of this, what seems like a complicated obsession to us, is a beautiful reminder daily, moment by moment, of the presence of God in your life and your relationship to him. And so this is the purpose of the law. When you reduce it to mere following of rules, when you start deciding which rules are greater or lesser, those you can break with impunity and those you can't, how in the world can you find the life and the awareness of God's presence that that the law was originally intended to give you. You can't do it, Jesus is saying. It doesn't work that way. We have to find another way to do this. So if we were to paraphrase that verse, verse 18, until heaven and earth, individuality and community, cross boundaries and merge into oneness, not even the smallest part of the instruction and guidance that strengthens us will pass away until it has fulfilled its purpose and is no longer needed. That's getting us to the Aramaic understanding. That's how we can start to understand what's going on here. The law is meant to bring us into unity. When that happens, the law no longer exists in our hearts. The law was always supposed to be written on our hearts, not followed. And so Jesus is saying that this attitude needs to go. This attitude needs to change. And then he takes us to the next verse, Matthew 5:20. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now this means little to us, but it was mind-blowing to the Jews. Because we were just talking about these Pharisees, how they were the lawyers, they were the doctors of the law. They had this thing all mapped out to the nth degree. And Jesus is saying you're supposed to surpass that? How in the world are you going to surpass that? Nobody but the Pharisees could even understand the law the way that they interpreted it. That's why they had to go to them to find out if they were clean or unclean or what they needed to do to become part of society again. This is why the rabbis held such power over the people. And now Jesus is saying you need to surpass that. This is a pivotal verse. This verse really, for my money, is the topic sentence of the whole chapter and maybe the whole sermon. You know, we made it the password for our network here, Matthew 5:20, just to keep reminding, you know. It's okay that you know that. Wireless is free here. Matthew 5:20, it's a pivotal verse because it's telling us exactly what this formula is. We need to surpass this legalistic attitude. We need to move beyond the mere following of rules. Something else needs to happen. And so this law and this tradition of the Pharisees really knew no bounds. Remember I told you that there were 613 laws that the Jews understood? There was 248 of action, positive action that needed to be taken, 365 prohibitions, negative laws that they had to follow. And those that they deemed important, what they did was they built hedges around those, what they called hedges or fences, with other rules and other laws that were part of what they called the oral tradition. They weren't written down. The Pharisees came up with these themselves in order to protect. In other words, you'd have to break a bunch of these hedges or fences before you ever broke a law. Maybe you can understand it this way. You ever heard the old joke, why do Baptists not allow premarital sex? Because it leads to dancing. This is how it gets all turned around. This is how it gets all backwards, right? Premarital sex is something that the church is really trying to keep from happening. So anything that would lead to that, dancing, you know, what happens in dancing? No dancing because it leads to sex. But after a while, the hedge, the protection, becomes more important than the law it was meant to protect. This was happening constantly in Jewish culture with the Pharisees. It happens in our culture now, you know. I've had people tell me that there's not going to be any electric guitars in heaven, as if the form of the music was going to be detrimental to our spiritual expression or experience. We get everything back to front. And the Pharisees took this to an absolutely incredible degree. I want to read you just a little bit from my book, The Fifth Way, because I want you to try to get a feel for exactly how far this went, how bad it was, why Jesus was working so hard to fix this. 613 commandments. One of them is to keep holy the Sabbath day. So at Exodus 35, 2 and 3. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day you shall have a holy day, a Sabbath of complete rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. Wow. Even though it was never really carried out much as far as we can tell in ancient times, still, the penalty was death. You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day. So, in addition to knowing about the penalty, we also know that you can't kindle a fire. But it doesn't really tell us much about what this servile work, what is this work? What does that mean? Can I take a walk without breaking a Sabbath? Can my children play? Can we prepare a meal without a fire? Or what if the fire is still burning from the day before? Can I use it? Can I read? Carry a book from the shelf to a chair? Can I write? Can I deal with an emergency such as a broken bone or a hole in the roof? Can I care for my sick child? You see, once you take the law and reduce it to mere rules, look at all the legal questions that start to arise. You know, the U.S. Constitution is only about, 8 pages long. What does our legal code look like today? Based on just that tiny document, everybody had to interpret and reinterpret and add rules and regulations. We've got probably billions of lines of code by now, trying just to adjudicate that little tiny document. Same thing is happening here. So, the rabbis eventually delineated 39 hedges around the Sabbath law, 39 categories of activities that would be prohibited on Shabbat, on Sabbath. So they take this rule, all right, and they have to define it. They have to tell everybody exactly what they can and can't do. That way, you would break all of these unwritten rules before you ever broke the main rule. 39. Categories. These 39 categories prohibited work that was either creative or exercised dominion over the environment and were loosely divided into 4 groups. Activities required to make bread, such as sowing, plowing, reaping, threshing, winnowing, grinding, sifting, kneading, baking. Activities to make a garment, such as shearing or washing or beading or dyeing or spinning or weaving 2 more loops or threads, tying or untying, stitching, tearing. Activities required to make leather, trapping, slaughtering, flaying, tanning, scraping, cutting, marking, writing or erasing 2 or more letters, and activities required to build a house, building, demolishing, kindling, extinguishing fire, finishing, transporting objects more than 4 cubits, just a few feet. You know, when Jesus heals the man at the Bethesda pool, he didn't break the Sabbath when he did that. When he told him to pick up his pallet and walk, now he broke the oral tradition, and he did it on purpose. When he used mud, he spit in his hand and took dirt and mixed it into a mud paste and put it on the blind man's eyes to heal him. If he just healed him with the word, he didn't break anything. But as soon as he made the mud paste, he was kneading, and he was breaking the oral tradition on purpose. He's trying to make a point here. But as restrictive as these 39 may be, they were only categories of activities, each containing many more activities within them. So within each category of work, or melacha, there were direct derivative activities called toledot that carried nearly the same legal severity as the original melacha. Then there were also indirect derivative activities called shevut that carried much less severe punishments if violated. In this way, baking, as melacha, carried within it the prohibitions against cooking, poaching, and roasting, all toledot under baking. And even if you weren't making bread, there wasn't much else you could do in the kitchen either on Shabbat, so meals needed to be prepared the day before. And since winnowing, as melacha, referred to separating chaff from grain or making something edible which was previously inedible, it was also unlawful to filter undrinkable water to make it drinkable or to pick small bones from fish. That's why you got gefilte fish. You heard of gefilte fish? It's pickled so that you can just eat the bones. You don't have to pick them out. From one commandment to 39 melacha to dozens of toledot and dozens more shevut, restrictions exponentially grew. And keeping in mind that the Shabbat commandment was only one of 613 laws the rabbis recognized, starts to bring the incredibly vast scope of the oral tradition into view. Do you see what the people were up against? Do you see why Jesus was going nuts? Realizing that these rabbis had created a system that nobody could understand, nobody could follow through with, and nobody could enter kingdom through. This was Jesus' whole purpose, was to give people a chance to be able to become one with their Father again. He needed to break this down. He needed to take it where it needed to go. And so, let's read a paraphrase of what this could actually look like. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. For the purpose of the law becomes, when the purpose of the law becomes one with God's desire, and one and the same with your desire within, when you begin to fulfill the purpose of the law and not just follow rules, when you value others more than yourself, when you see God in every breath, face, and moment, you are already in the kingdom by definition, and not an instant before. This is what Jesus is trying to tell us. The law is not an absolute instrument, and it's certainly not the test of our acceptability to God. We have to understand that. Jesus was trying to bring an understanding of a good news. Good news does not entail hundreds or thousands of rules that must be followed in order to be acceptable to that very God. Jesus, with his life, showed us that we are acceptable because we're sitting here breathing and for no other reason. Nothing, as Paul says, can separate us from the love of God. The law was meant to help us to move into this awareness, not as an instrument for dividing us from that. There's an analogy that I like to use. Y'all know what a Jell-O mold is, right? No? It's shaped like something. You pour the Jell-O into it. You let the Jell-O harden. And when you pull the mold away, you got a Jell-O that looks like a fish. You got Jell-O that looks like whatever it happens to be. Maybe it's just the cup, but it looks like that. The law is like a Jell-O mold. If we pour our lives and pour ourselves into the mold, and if we will keep it there long enough, eventually you can pull the mold away, and we look like the law. This is the intent of law. It's meant to mold us and shape us. It's meant to give us guidelines and instruction. It's meant to lead us to an experience that will take us exactly where we need to go. But as soon as we just follow it to the letter for its own sake, as if that law could save us, as if following the law perfectly was what God needed from us in order to accept us, we have completely lost our way and lost the law's ability to help us in any way that is at all positive. There was an ancient Chinese philosopher, actually, and he said that the purpose of a fish trap is to catch a fish. And once the fish is caught, the trap is forgotten. And the purpose of a rabbit snare is to catch a rabbit. And once the rabbit is caught, the trap is forgotten. He said the purpose of words is to convey ideas. And once the ideas are grasped, then the words can be forgotten. He said, who is the person who has forgotten words? He's the one I want to talk to. So here we go with this idea here, that the purpose of law is to catch God's righteousness. What is that righteousness? It's multiple things functioning as one. It's connection. It's unity. It looks like love. It's people bound together. That's God's righteousness. The purpose of the law is to catch God's righteousness, that unity and connection. And once the righteousness is grasped, then the law can be forgotten. Show me someone who's forgotten law. He or she is the one I want to obey, because they're living law from the inside out. They have learned to love the law. They have learned what the law means to their life and to their moments and to their relationships. There was another wise man who said that, see if I can get this, justice that love gives is a surrender. Justice that law gives is a punishment. Where is the person who has forgotten law? They're the one I want to obey. Jesus was such a person. He understood the purpose of law. Law, like the Beatitudes, is giving us that picture of the finished product. A person who has a law written on their hearts looks like the Beatitudes and has the effect of salt and light. It's all there. Loving their God and neighbor makes us consistently aware of God's presence in our moments, in our relationships. Our connection to God is relational. It's not legal. Following rules has nothing to do with the relationship that we have with our God. And so until heaven and earth pass away, cross boundaries, become one, the law is only needed until that moment when that unity is connection. If you think about it, the purpose of law is to make heaven and earth pass away, to become one. And as soon as they do, the law is fulfilled. That's why Paul can say to love our neighbor as ourselves is the fulfillment of the law. Jesus says the same thing. And what does that look like? What does it look like in our moments, in our lives? I think there's no more beautiful example of what this idea of love looks like than the father of the prodigal son. Here is a son who tells his father, in effect, I wish you were dead. All you mean to me is the inheritance that you can give me. Give me that inheritance and I'm out of here. And he goes away and he squanders the wealth and with little more than enlightened self-interest decides that at least the hired hands in my father's household are living better than I am, so I'm going to go back and I'm just going to hire on as one of his slaves. At least I'll be better than this. And he's rehearsing his speech all the way home. But what he doesn't realize is there was not a single moment that his father wasn't looking for him to come over the horizon line and start walking down the path to his property. There wasn't a moment, there wasn't a day that he wasn't waiting at the window and looking out the door and waiting for signs that his son had returned. And when he sees him, he doesn't just wait for him to come. He lifts up his robes and he sprints. And if you know anything about Hebrew patriarchs, you know that they don't run. That's undignified. And you know that they don't lift up their skirts because that's immodest. They are the patriarchs. They are the kings of their clan. And here he is running for all he's worth, sprinting to this son who smells like pig excrement because that's where he was sleeping. And the scriptures tell us that he doesn't just kiss him. He drapes himself around his son and he can't stop kissing him. Before his son gets one word out, before his son has proven anything to him that he has changed or that anything is different in the relationship, it doesn't matter. Law does not matter to the relationship we have in our God. When we get that, we get everything. And so Jesus is telling us as hard and as emphatically and as often as he can, your relationship is good news. Not legal news, good news. And the good news is there is no bad news. We are as forgiven as we want to be. Let's pray. Father, this is a hard lesson. Everything in our experience points us in a different direction. Everything that we've been taught points us in a different direction. This one is difficult, but without it, it's so hard to find you, to trust you. To know that we can trust you with everything in our lives. So help us. Help our unbelief. We believe, help our unbelief. It's a difficult, difficult thing, but it can be done. It can be done in you. Help us to take the steps that will take us to the experiences of your love and trustworthiness that will let us know that you are really there. You are really that good, really that trustworthy, that connected, and that loving. Father, we can only love you because you loved us first. We thank you with everything in us. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.